Hi, I'm Connie Dover, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brownhill. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, host Craig Lubo talks with Ray Crone about his journey to death row and his battle for exoneration. Then, in the second half of the show, host Jessica Thomas talks with Ethan Thampy of Americans for Forfeiture Reform about cannabis legislation initiatives on ballots across the nation. Have your pens and paper ready for our calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news after the show. Up next, Craig and his guests.
Hey, this is Craig Lubo. Today I have Ray Crone with me. He is going to be discussing wrongful convictions. He was convicted in Arizona in 1991, the murder and kidnapping. He was also charged with sexual assault, but was found not guilty. If you can just give some background to what they alleged happened in the crime.
The murder happened and occurred in a bar there, a local bar. The owner came in the morning, a Sunday morning, and found the front door unlocked. Wondered why his night manager hadn't secured the property. He made his way through the bar, checking on his personal money, and he found the Kim and Kona line at puddle of blood, stabbed to death in the men's bathroom. There was no evidence of a break-in, no robbery, so the police, of course, were called and initiated this investigation under the assumption that it had to be somebody that knew her, somebody had a relationship with her, because there was no sign of a break-in or robbery. And they called in co-workers, and one of the co-workers mentioned me as a boyfriend, alleged boyfriend. I was questioned shortly after that about being a boyfriend. Of course, I told him I wasn't a boyfriend. I'd been to that bar a few times. I played darts there. I shot volleyball. I played volleyball for their team. But during that interview, they noticed I had crooked teeth. They remembered seeing marks in the body. Just 2 days later, a medical examiner had looked at my teeth, had looked at the marks, and identified, saying it was a match, and I was arrested.
When you say they said it was a match, you talk about the bite marks. How did they get a sample from you?
Initially, there were marks on her left breast, and there were some knife wounds. She'd been stabbed to death. The fatal blow came from a stab through the back, but there were some knife wounds appeared on her neck. They also identified some bite marks there. It wasn't like a full set of teeth like you think biting into a sandwich, but there were some marks. The first day I was questioned by the police, they actually had a piece of styrofoam, kind of like a coffee cup, cut out and taped together, had me bite into that. I didn't know what was going on. I had no information about the murder. I wasn't fed any information. It wasn't on the news. I cooperated that day. After about 3-hour interrogation, I was left taken home. The next day, after I got home from working the post office that day, the detective was there and said, I need to ask you a few more questions. Presented me with a search warrant, at which point it said they was required to give. I was required to give a blood sample, hair sample, and take casts of my teeth. They had a dentist then take the actual metal cast and took two casts of my upper, two casts of my lower. Then the next day is when I was arrested. So it was based on the bite mark that they got from the styrofoam, the cast of the teeth, and then we actually found pictures later on that they took those casts once they made them on my teeth, took them to the body in the morgue and actually placed them on the breast and said, see how this lines up. And they got the arrest warrant, and I was arrested.
But you said they took blood, too. So what did they do with that evidence? Was it used, or?
Because it was a violent stabbing in the back with a butcher knife, they believed there was a possibility of the perpetrator actually cutting himself. There was such a forceful blow, it actually bent the butcher knife in half when it went through her ribs. However, all the blood that they found at the scene of the crime could only be identified as hers. There was nothing they didn't know it was. But she was a type O and I was a type O, so they tried to infer that it could have been my blood, the way they do notoriously sometimes. They said it was consistent with the blood found at the crime scene. I believe they said about 30% of the population is type O.
Was there DNA testing available at that time?
This was in 1992 when I came to trial in early August, late July of 92. That was out there. They had taken a swab from the area, from the bite mark area, from the neck area. Apparently, they had done their own little test with what limited knowledge there was at that time. They couldn't link it to me, so they denied they ever did it.
Okay, so you're saying they denied that they did the DNA test?
Yeah, they said there was no DNA taken, done.
Now, what about the attorney that represented you? Did he try to obtain samples of it to have his own expert test it?
Unfortunately, I wasn't a millionaire or a wealthy person. I couldn't come up with hundreds of thousands of dollars or more that it takes to hire an attorney. I trusted the system because I was innocent, and I was appointed a court-appointed attorney. So, no, he really didn't do any of that. He did what he got paid for, practically nothing. He just stood in that courtroom. because it was, you know, he was way underpaid and very little evidence was ever introduced. My first trial lasted just 3.5 days in the capital murder case. It was about biting into that styrofoam, why that dentist was there. The prosecution actually introduced a bite mark expert, a very well-spoken, convincing, powerful speaker. He was a state senator from Las Vegas. He was the dean of the UNLV Dental School. He was an elder in the Mormon Church. The curriculum vitae went on and on. We also found out later on that he was well paid. He was paid over $50,000 by the prosecution for his testimony, his work on my case. So I believe over the course of the 10 years I was in prison, about 18 or 20 bite mark experts reviewed my case. The worst anyone ever said was it was inconclusive. Everybody else was absolutely sure it was not a match, except the man, Ray Rosen, hired by the prosecutor, who to this day said, I never claimed he killed her, I just said he bit her. But yes, during that time, attorneys, and it has evolved from being a way to identify. Ray Rosen actually had the nerve to say that it was comparable to fingerprints. It was completely, you know, independent. Each person's bite was different. And since then now, and they had to really clean up their own mess from people that would actually say that it's a perfect match. They actually now, the latest I've heard now, forensic odontology should only be used for exclusion. It should only be used for absolutely declaring that no, that could not be that person's bite mark. But nothing to have at all with inclusion.
And I think some states that were allowing bite mark evidence have now started not to allow it.
They may well so. I know there was an independent study done. It was actually done quite a few years back on forensic odontology, and they took a known bite mark, and they had like 6 samples of dentition, casts of teeth, and they had them do like a blind study, a test to see who could match it up with only 6 choices, and it was something less than 60% of them got it right.
You were found not guilty of the sexual assault. So a couple questions I have relating to that. In Arizona, then, is the death penalty available without a sexual offense?
Yes, in Arizona, they actually had other aggravating factors, everything from just being senseless of the crime to the helplessness of the victim. Also, accessing pain and suffering, which was used in my case, saying this bite mark on her breast was either just prior to her death when she had to suffer extremely from that painful bite mark, or it was just after death, and that was tampering with a dead body that was heinous and depraved. So, the rape charge, sexual assault charges, didn't really affect the option of a death sentence. Yeah, I believe at that time there was about 8 or 9 at least aggravating factors that only needed any one of them to qualify for death sentence.
You got the death penalty initially. So what happened from there?
From there I went to death row. I spent the next 3 years there in a 6x8 cell, no contact, physical contact with other inmates. I got out of that cell 3 times a week for 2 hours after being shackled and handcuffed at both the waist and the ankles. And meanwhile, as in all states, your case makes its way straight to the Supreme Court of that state. It took 3 years for them to review my case. I have to say, thank goodness, my attorney was actually awake and paying attention during the trial. Just the day before my trial was to start, the prosecution introduced a videotape made by this bite mark expert. It was about 45 minutes, very impressive display of how he matched my teeth to this mark. My attorney was awake. He actually paid attention at the time. He objected to the admission of this evidence. The judge denied, said he was going to allow the evidence in, and then my attorney actually asked for a 30-day continuance, which the judge again denied. He said, we need to get this trial rolling. Now, he was an ex-prosecutor. He was responsible for a handful of people on death row already. Just 7.5 months after Kim's body was found, they had to get this trial rolling. It was his exact words. And when the Arizona Supreme Court reviewed this, they recognized it for what it was. It was a violation of the rules of discovery. As a defendant, you have a right to know what evidence is going to be used against you and receive it in a timely manner. They said the judge was wrong to admit this at that such a late date, and then they went on to say that my attorney was well within his rights to ask for that continuance. But in Arizona is one of those where they have what they call harmless error evaluation, where even if there is a mistake, an error, an omission made, it does not mean you automatically get a new trial. They have to determine whether or not it would have affected the verdict. Did it matter? And in my case, the Arizona Supreme Court actually said without this videotape, there wasn't even a jury submissible case against Mr. Crone, and I was ordered to stand a new trial. I did. That trial started in 1996. Now, by then, I'd been on death row for 3 years. They had executed a number of people. Me and my family both knew that the state of Arizona could and would kill you, that the issue of innocence wasn't an issue for them. It was a matter of closing a case and saving face. My folks were very concerned after having come visit me, seeing the conditions, seeing what happened there in Arizona. They actually mortgaged their home, cashed in their 401ks, retirement plans. I had local friends back in my town in Pennsylvania that made donations to my family. Friends that my parents grew up with gave their income tax return checks to them, and we were able to hire an attorney out of Southern California. We didn't want anything to do with the local Arizona connection. Now, again, we couldn't come near the $100,000 that a capital case normally costs, but this attorney had become familiar with my case because of the bite mark, the questionable, bite mark evidence, and said, look, just pay the expenses. And that trial began in February of 1996, and in comparison, that trial lasted 7 weeks. Over 500 exhibits were introduced. We actually had 3 bite mark experts testify for the defense.
Were you convicted again?
Well, after all that time sitting through that trial, it even came out during that trial that we found out that they had taken swabs from that bite mark, that they had tried to do DNA testing. They said it was destroyed. It was used up. We were able to track it down at a laboratory in Colorado, and were able to take the last little bit of samples and take it out to Dr. Blake in California and have him, I believe it's PCR, it's called it, but it's where you replicate the DNA. And he actually came back with a report that the DNA, the saliva from the bite mark that I'm supposed to make, was not my DNA. No way, no how. So you can imagine how great that sounded in that court of law, to be sitting there, finally the truth is coming out. Unfortunately, I still didn't realize the gravity of this situation, how important it is for a prosecutor to get a guilty conviction in a death penalty case. That's that is the highest case, is the trial that they'll ever be through as a capital murder case, and you better win at all costs. And in my case, the prosecutor actually told the jury in closing arguments, the last words he said to that jury is to disregard that DNA, to ignore it. It had no bearing in this case. It was easy to explain. She's a waitress. She handles glass and bottles all day long. That was just transferred to her breast by accident. The jury was out for 3.5 days. And yes, they did come back and find me guilty again. Well, at this time, again in Arizona at that time, the jury handled the guilt phase. The judge handled the sentencing phase. The jury was dismissed. So I had to come back in about 4 months later and go before the judge in what's called an aggravating mitigating hearing, where he hears the aggravating side from the prosecution, why this should be a death penalty case, why it's above and beyond the norm. And then the mitigating's put on then by the defense, why it should be less, not a death sentence.
And was it the same judge?
No, it was the same judge that was sat through trial. It was not the same judge I had the first trial.
Okay.
But in this case, the judge has sat through 7 weeks and heard all this testimony. In the first trial, I told my attorney I have nothing to mitigate. I didn't do it. And so there was no mitigation put on. The second trial, I told my attorney the same thing. I got nothing to mitigate. I didn't kill Kim. He goes, you let me handle this. And for the next 2 hours, basically, he went over all the piece of evidence that came out during that second trial. Why footprints in the kitchen where the murder weapon was taken from, same footprints around Kim's body that they had actually used a dust and a light and taken the perfect print and went and bought the exact shoe to match this print they lifted. Size 9.5 Converse. I wear a size 11. My bare foot was bigger than the whole shoe. Why fingerprints and palm prints in the men's bathroom where the knife was washed and dried and hidden underneath the trash can liner. None of those prints matched me. Why DNA on Kim's body, hair on Kim's body did not match me. And when he was done after going over all this stuff at the mitigating hearing, the judge ruled that there was lingering and residual doubt of my guilt. He said that was a mitigating factor that outweighed the aggravating factor, and so he sentenced me to 25 to life instead for the murder, and then added on 21 more for the kidnapping.
Was that case, was your new conviction appealed as well directly to the Supreme Court then?
Well, in Arizona, if you don't get a death sentence, any other sentence is appealed to the appellate courts first. It took a couple years. Meanwhile, I went to the walls in maximum security prison with armed guards on the towers, walking around with other inmates, the most dangerous and violent inmates. During that time, then my appeal was sent to the Arizona appellate courts. After a few years, it was turned down. They said it was a fair trial. There was no issues raised, nothing that they, they don't review the evidence. They just said it was legally, a fair trial. I'd see people on newspaper or TV getting released because of DNA, and first thought is, yay, that could be me one day because I'm innocent too. And then on the other hand, I think, yeah, a lot of good DNA did me.
When the appeals court reviewed the case, what did they say, or did they say anything about the trial judge not allowing the DNA evidence to be admitted?
Well, while it was admitted, they said it was up to the jury's decision that the words the prosecution said, was since the prosecutor is allowed to say whatever they want in closing arguments, they didn't question any of that. Most of mine was concerned about a hearsay. There was one person alleged that I told them I was coming in to help close up. It never happened. They couldn't verify it. They said Kim told her I was coming in. That was one of the issues. There was an issue about, I believe there's an identification of a person that had been there and identified somebody else that did not match me, and that wasn't allowed in. But they're really, shamefully, the bite mark evidence, which should have been the most question of all, was not an appealable issue. And the appellate court actually ruled that it was fair, and the judge didn't make mistakes. The prosecution didn't do anything wrong, and my attorney was competent enough in defending me, and that I had no relief coming.
The part about the transference, saliva, that didn't come up then until closing argument?
Yeah, the prosecutor used that as the last words he spoke to the jury before they went out to deliberate. That was his explanation to the jury to say this DNA was meaningless and it had no bearing on the case. We know Crone did it because we had the bite mark evidence.
In terms of his arguments about that DNA evidence, had he also put on expert to rebut that evidence?
The prosecution actually did have a DNA person from the FBI actually testified. There was hairs found on the body also that could not match me, and they originally said they were microscopically indistinguishable, but once testing was done, of course, that wasn't true. And again, the difference between the technology in 92 and technology in 96, there was a lot of advances in DNA. But the prosecution really didn't object to the DNA testing. He just tried to make an excuse for why it was there. But the key evidence, it turned out, everything in the newspapers was all about bite mark evidence. It was all about I could hide everything, but I couldn't hide my teeth.
And what happened after the appeals court made their decision?
Well, of course, the next step, then it's possible to go into the Arizona Supreme Court, and then you can go federal. During that time where we were working on another appeals, the state of Arizona in 2001 passed a new law. They recognized the validity, the importance of DNA testing. Most states all have a time limit, a window when you can bring up post-conviction relief, when new evidence can be introduced and asked to be reviewed. In most states, it's less than 2 years. Some states, it's even as short as 6 months. But Arizona recognized that DNA, even for previous cases, you know, years before DNA was available, could still be tested if it was properly secured and maintained, preserved. And they passed a law saying that you could ask for post-conviction relief for review of evidence if it was properly maintained, if it had direct bearing on guilt or innocence. And in my case, we found out that the clothing that had been cut off of Kim in the attack had been thrown in the men's bathroom, and that had been saved by the police department, been preserved. My attorneys were able to get a look at that. They realized there were some kind of stains on her underwear inside of her jeans, which meant it had to happen after her clothing was off. And so we petitioned under that new law to get these clothing tested. And, of course, there was a hearing. There was objections from the prosecution saying it was a wild goose chase, a fishing expedition, a waste of the court's time and money, on and on about how I've been convicted twice of a jury, overwhelming evidence of my guilt. Don't grant this motion, Your Honor. And for whatever reason, that judge did order that testing to be done, and he ordered the Phoenix Police Department's recently accredited DNA lab then in 2000, by then it was 2002, to do that DNA testing. For me, that was the fortunate thing, because obviously, after all I've been through, the last people in the world I wanted to trust was the Phoenix Police Department. But the fortunate part was, by that time, there was a DNA database all around the country, and only law enforcement agencies have access to the DNA data bank, where DNA was stored from criminals all over the U.S. And so when the lab technician there at the Phoenix Police Department extracted DNA from the pants, found some more in the underwear, compared it was the same DNA in both the pants and underwear, then compared it to me, and it wasn't my DNA, compared it to the victims, it wasn't hers, which was all the court order required, on her own. And I say, you go, girl. God bless this overachiever. She decided to take and put that in the National DNA Database. And that's when it came back with the match.
And it was a match for somebody else.
Yes, it came back with the match to a man at that moment there in early 2002 was serving a 10-year sentence for having sexually assaulted a child just 3 months after the murder. A man who at the time of the murder was actually out on parole for another sexual offense 4 or 5 years earlier was paroled to his mom's house, whose address was just a few blocks away from the bar in Phoenix, Arizona.
And so after the DNA test was done, did you get another court hearing for that then?
Because that was a post-conviction relief or Rule 32, it actually would have had to go before a judge who would have ordered a new trial. But before that happened, I was actually on a yard in Yuma, Arizona at the time. I got a call over to the counselor's office, and he said, your attorney's on the phone. And my attorney said, Ray, how you doing today? I said, fine, just another day in paradise. And He laughed. He said, well, what are you hungry for? I said, well, what are you talking about? Eat whatever's in the chow hall. He goes, no, really, what do you want? Steak, seafood, Mexican food, a beer? What would you like? I said, Alan, what the devil are you talking about? He said, I just got off the phone with the prosecutor's office. They just got back from the judge's chambers. They're cutting the paperwork. You're coming home today. And, of course, I couldn't believe what I just heard. My knees are shaking. My voice is breaking. I said, well, what did you just say? He said, roll up, Ray. It's all over. You're coming home. 4 hours later, I walked out of that prison looking over my shoulder, wondering what are they up to this time, because they never tried this tactic before. They never tried to release me. They always fought me. And I actually got out that day on April 8th, 2002, after 10 years, 3 months, and 8 days in prison. But I wasn't technically free yet. I still had to go before a judge. That was 3 weeks I had to be on OR, waiting, staying in a hotel there in Phoenix, Arizona. When I went before the judge that day, at which point the judge recognized the DNA, the testing, at that point he ordered a new trial. And then the prosecutor stepped forward and said that they were dropping charges with prejudice, meaning that we could no longer be charged, that I was, and then that the judge banged the gavel and said, Mr. Crone, you're free to go. At which point I was officially exonerated from that murder.
You mentioned your family had to mortgage their house, etc. By you being charged with a crime you didn't commit, besides you being a victim, the family was a victim too.
Absolutely, and all along, having grew up in a small town, you know, a lot of people know what it's like growing up in a small town. The day you're born, you already have a reputation based on your last name. Everybody knew everybody. I went to the same high school my grandparents went to, the same church my great-grandparents went to. At the age of 17, graduated from high school, I went into service, so I didn't get back to my hometown that often. But you're not forgotten when you're in a small town. And those people, all of them stood by me those years, even not having not seen me in 20 years, still believed in me in prison. So I was very thankful and honored by that show of support. It doesn't happen very often. And so many people were responsible for giving me that strength to endure each and every day in prison, waking up again in that hell saying, how am I ever going to get out of here? It's through the strength of their support that gave me the strength to continue on. And finally, that one day that came, that I was free, and I did go back to my small town and thank each and every one of them for what they'd done. I don't know what I'd have done. I couldn't wake up one day in prison and say, okay, I had enough, I want to go home now. But each and every one of them could have said, I've done all I can for him. I'm broke, I don't have any more emotions left, I'm just going to quit on him. Nobody did that on me for 10 years. They stood behind me.
And my understanding is you had never been charged or convicted with any type of crime before this occurred, is that right?
Oh, it's absolutely true. In my background, even from that small town, I played Little League baseball, peewee football. I was in the church choir. I was in the Boy Scouts. I graduated in the top 15% of my high school. I spent 6 years in the U.S. Air Force with an honorable discharge, a top secret clearance I had. From after the service, a couple years later, I got a job with the post office. I was a mailman at the time of my arrest, 7 years. I didn't even have traffic violations. Now, I'm not saying I was an angel. I don't think anybody is. But clearly, I had no background, no reason to ever go and commit a murder. But none of that was taken into consideration. I was sent to death row.
A lot of people, I think, operate under the myth that from, like, that movie Conviction, where a lot of people that wrongfully convicted, that they think they brought it upon themselves because of their prior histories.
It's funny how sometimes we still want to justify a system that makes mistakes. It's run by humans. We still want to justify it and say the innocent victim is actually at fault.
As far as the prosecutor, the original one has never acknowledged that it was a wrongful conviction?
No, my original prosecutor has never addressed me since my release. He's never acknowledged publicly anything about it. Making a mistake. He actually retired just recently, last couple of years, with a Lifetime Meritorious Achievement Award. I was fortunate enough to receive an apology, which is not something you receive often. It came from the legislatures. I was at both the House and the Senate in Arizona, at which point one of the senators stood up and interrupted the proceedings and took about 10 minutes to tell my story. He said, Ray Crone's here in the gallery right now, and they all stood up and clapped and apologized, and everybody stood up and clapped. I'm told that was the first time it ever happened in the United States that a legislative body ever apologized. Sorry, this would have been in about 2005, I believe it was. I also had numerous apologies from other people involved, externally from my case, people that were in Arizona but weren't the lead detectives or the prosecution. And I'm thankful. I wish my family was there for all of it. But, you know, it would have meant just so much to me if it could have just had that prosecutor and that detective stand there and say, I made a mistake, Mr. Croon, I'm sorry. And you know what? Neither am big enough a man to do that.
But it sounds like, too, that the prosecutor actually hid evidence if they did the DNA test and cut that out.
It actually got so bad, when I was released that day, as I said, I had to wait 3 weeks to go before the judge. During that 3 weeks, the prosecution was trying to make a deal with the murderer, Kenneth Phillips, to avoid the death penalty if he'd say I was there with him. To say that I was an accomplice, just to keep me and my family looking, you know, like monsters. And so at that point, I was so angry that I finally said, you know what, I talked with some lawyers. We were able to find out, actually, not only was the DNA denied that they ever had any, and we ever found that during trial, we also found out that they actually, within the first month of my arrest, the bite mark evidence was sent off to an expert in San Diego who sent back and told him, you better have more than this, it's not a match. They covered that up and went shopping for another expert. We found out that they changed the original police report when they had bought those shoes to match after my arrest just 2 days later. They found out that on my smallest shoe I had in my closet was a size 10.5. They changed the police report, made a new police report, and now said it was between 10.5 and 11.5. So all these things combined, we found out years later, going after the city and county, you can't sue a prosecutor, they got total immunity, but you can't sue a county for failure to train and supervise its employee.
Thank you, Ray.
And now, the calendar for November 3rd, 2014. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, November 3rd, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Sholto Drive, Kansas City, Missouri. They will be making plans for the upcoming legislative session. The church is also accepting donations of non-perishable food for the weekend backpack program for underprivileged students. For more information, contact Robin Johnson, 816-522-4081, or email redrob2655@yahoo.com. Samuel U. Rogers Health Center will hold an open house to kick off open enrollment in the health insurance marketplace on Saturday, November 15th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Samuel U. Rogers Education Center at 2100 East 9th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. The center is located one block south of the main campus at 815 Euclid Avenue in Kansas City, Missouri. Patients and the public are invited to come and learn about new health care coverage options for 2015. Speak to a marketplace counselor and make appointments to get in-person help to apply. There will be refreshments and some raffle prizes as well. Open enrollment in the healthcare insurance marketplace for 2015 starts on November 15th and ends on February 15th. The Kansas City chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will have their regular monthly meeting on Tuesday, November 4th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. The guest speaker will be a retired social worker, Jim Mooney, who will address the importance of connecting with the family members of murder victims. My name is Keith Brownhill, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. KKFI.org.
Good morning, and you're listening to the Jaws of Justice here on 90.1 FM. And in the studio with me, I'm Jessica Thomas. And in the studio with me, Eapen Thampy with Americans for Forfeiture Reform. Hi, Eapen. Thanks for coming in today.
Hey, Jessica. How are you?
Really good. And we're all looking at our electronic devices today. There's a lot of things going on with elections coming around the corner tomorrow, and we're going to be speaking to that. Regionally, we don't really have any initiatives on the Missouri ballot for cannabis.
No, we don't. We do have the chance, however, to elect a variety of state representatives and senators who have, you know, different positions on drug policy and marijuana reform. So we don't have a ballot measure or a legislative agenda at the moment, but we are just, you know, seeing what we can do with the people who are running for office.
I saw that Shawmee Cannabis had a survey of its political, of those candidates that are running, and it kind of show some of the backgrounds on where they stand on the issue of cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's available for people to look at, is it? No?
Yeah, you go to showmecannabis.com. The electoral guide that we put out, it should be up on the website, on the blog.
And it's an important time for people to take notice. It's not just on a local level. But let's talk about really quick about Colombia. What happened in Colombia with the decriminalization?
So Show Me Cannabis board chairman Dan Vietz, a criminal defense attorney in Colombia, has been working for the last year with Columbia, Missouri City Councilwoman Barbara Hoppe. And Ms. Hoppe, earlier in the year, introduced a bill that would have decriminalized the cultivation of up to 6 marijuana plants in the household. And so what happened, how that played out was, so this bill was introduced about a year ago. Over the last year, one of the other city council seats was up for election in Columbia's first ward, which is where I'm registered to vote. And the woman who ran for that seat and ended up winning it, Ginny Chadwick, as part of her platform said, yes, I will support this decriminalization of marijuana cultivation. That was a campaign promise she made. The ordinance finally came to a vote about a week or so ago, and she broke her promise to support this ordinance, and she was actually the swing vote that prevented the ordinance's passage. And when we walked out of the city council room, and we said she broke her promise to us, and she'd actually alienated a number of other constituencies with some other things she had done. So we said we're going to lead a recall effort, and immediately we had, you know, four or five other groups calling us and saying we want to support you in recalling the city councilwoman who's broken her word to you and to us. You know, that's going to be a successful effort. I estimate that we've already collected the signatures that we need to recall her, although we'll be collecting for the next 2 weeks over-collecting so that we can demonstrate political strength in that district.
I don't think Kansas City listeners may not be familiar with the fact that Columbia did vote to decriminalize. There was the preface to that was
in 2004, coalition including Dan Vietz, Amber Langston, and another attorney named Anthony Johnson pushed through a decriminalization measure that decriminalized marijuana possession. That was 10 years ago. So, you know, now we're coming on the second wave kind of reform legislation that we're trying to get in Colombia. And that was, you know, can we start decriminalizing the cultivation, because we want to decrease the interactions that patients and people have with the drug dealers. You know, it's a violent market. Sometimes people get shot, and we want to allow, homegrown cultivation as a way to decrease interactions in the black market.
So as it stands, Columbia has decriminalization.
We have decriminalization of possession, but which is a good thing. You know, it's kind of Columbia is probably the most liberal area of Missouri in terms of marijuana reform. It's where I think there's a lot of people who've moved there. We have a medical marijuana ordinance that says that if you have a physician's recommendation, you're not subject to arrest, and that's also drawn people to Columbia. We have a lot of patients. We've got a good, stable community that's well-networked, that's tightly linked, that is now beginning to understand that we have substantial political power, and we're willing to use it.
You know, a lot of people won't admit to this fact that in areas that have a higher ratio of minority constituencies or whatever, if they're not voting, I don't think enough people are out there registered and voting myself, but areas that have significant minority populations will find that these areas are not going to go for decriminalization because the prison system, the legal systems, providing low skilled jobs in the prison systems and all that you know, stopping and shaking down a person, getting into the legal system, and then you've got money from probation, mm-hmm. Departments, all these things funneled into the system. So areas that have a higher minority rates are going to be less likely to look towards legalization.
Well, maybe. It's absolutely true that the war on drugs is a war on voter participation and representative democracy. But I think that we're finding that You know, after 40 years of mass incarceration and racially based enforcement, that a lot of attention is being given to the racial impact of drug prohibition. Law professor Michelle Alexander's recent book, The New Jim Crow, is probably the best articulation of this history. And it's, and her work has really demonstrated to a lot of people that, you know, 40 years, 50 years after the Civil Rights Act, after the Voting Rights Act, there is a tremendous problem. You know, we have more black men in jail right now than were in slavery. And that's a, that's
precisely
insane.
And what it makes up, you know, 80% or more of the prison population for cannabis crimes, yet it is actually, I think, the majority of the crimes are perpetrated by white men.
Well, usage rates of marijuana and other drugs are roughly equal, if not a little higher, you know, amongst whites than other demographics. But typically it's black men and Hispanics who go to jail for, you know, even minor drug crimes.
And so this war on drugs has really created a climate, a climate of fear of the jack-booted thugs busting in your door. But also, just like, and to honor this person, a Missouri deputy that was shot to death during a routine traffic stop. Not that this has anything to do with cannabis, however, it has set the climate of fear between the civilians and the police. There's been far more civilians shot by police than the police have been shot by civilians. But this recent tragedy where a father, a young 24, 25-year-old deputy in from El Dorado Springs, a Cedar County sheriff's deputy, was killed Saturday night. That kind of set up this climate for the police to be harmed because of fear. I mean, on both sides, this war on drugs has perpetrated.
Yeah, one of the horrible things the war on drugs has done to society is it's absolutely destroyed the relationship between some parts of the population and law enforcement. There is this no trust, there's no respect. And then there's the economy of violence that has kind of emerged around drug prohibition, because under drug prohibition, violent gangs and foreign cartels have the money and the desire to protect their turf and their business with weapons. So if you're asking, you know, serious questions as a society as why, what risks do law enforcement face, and why do we have so many guns on our streets, and why is there so much violence on the street? Well, one of the fundamental answers that implicates all of those is the war on drugs.
Indeed. And when you look at, let's say, Mexican cartels, where that violence has raged on for years, cross borders in that area, mm-hmm. A regular war, a war on people disappearing from both sides, from the cartels and the police. Mm-hmm. And then what you're getting into the United States, and you look at, say, a place like Kansas City, where we don't have cartels, it seems like more like the police are the cartel, are taking the role of the cartel in our society here.
You know, I think it's absolutely true that under drug prohibition, law enforcement has become a special interest, and they're most key on protecting their funding streams through federal grants, state grants, and asset forfeiture. And this is really a creature of bureaucracy and special interests. I mean, you have law enforcement agencies that no longer act in terms of their agenda is set more by the money and the revenues they receive than by the needs for public safety and public service that are actually out there.
So, another good question to ask or pose too. So I know that some of these Missouri drug task force are not adhering to the Sunshine Laws or the mm-hmm. complete transparency and funding. Well, my question is, these people are getting heavy artillery, tanks, door bashing, whatever, helicopters. I think Columbia even just recently, or was it Springfield that got a helicopter and a National Guard or?
Actually,
who trains Barney Fife to drive the helicopter and the tank? This is what I want to know.
Well, you know, I was in Ferguson on August 9th of this year, which is the day that Michael Brown was shot, and I had the unique chance to see the law enforcement response that night. And one of the things that struck me was the use of military helicopters to surveil and control the crowds of protesters in Ferguson that night. And why are they using military helicopters for crowd control? Well, the money for the teams that fly these helicopters is their salaries, that is, come from federal asset forfeiture. So, you know, the St. Charles County Sheriff or the St. Louis Metropolitan Police seizing money through civil asset forfeiture, and then that money goes to the feds and comes back to the department, and they use it to pay their salaries for their military helicopters and their militarized policing. And part of the issue here is that the money should, is that law enforcement has control of their own revenue stream, so they can do essentially whatever they want here. And part of the challenge for reformers is to demonstrate that we need to return to a system where the legislature is the sole appropriator of funding. You know, if the police, if law enforcement in the state or, you know, really any place in the country had to go to a legislature for funding, they probably wouldn't get, funds to buy armored, mine-resistant, armored vehicles or National Guard helicopters for the use in domestic surveillance or, you know, law enforcement.
So who is in control of each of these individual task force?
So
who's the oversight?
So there is supposed to be an executive board that includes representatives from any departments that comprise a task force. But we know that at least one task force in Missouri had no executive board, had no one running it legally. These boards.
Was this St. Louis? Was that an article that I'd read, where they just kind of.
Well, the St. Louis Metropolitan Drug Task Force's general counsel, a gentleman named Mark Lawson, has lied to us at least twice about the actual existence of his drug task force.
Right, it didn't exist.
Yes. So, you know, we sent him a request. Can you give us your records on this drug task force? He says it doesn't exist. We sent him a grant document that he had signed off on for $200,000 for this drug task force. And we said, you signed off on this grant request for this task force, and you're telling us it doesn't exist? And we haven't had a response yet. But he will probably face a lawsuit. And his legal license is also implicated, under the rules of professional conduct. You can't lie about a basic fact like that and keep your law license. So, you know, we'll see where that takes us.
And that brings up an interesting point because, the city council was sued. And lost.
Oh, you're talking about Springfield.
Springfield?
Yes.
Yes.
So, yeah, in 2012, Show Me Cannabis funded a signature drive in Springfield, Missouri, and it was to model the legislation that had the decriminalization of possession legislation that had been passed in Columbia and St. Louis. And the petitioners in Springfield got their signatures, and the way it works in Springfield is the ordinance will go to the city council after you collect your signatures, and if they reject it, it goes to a ballot. So the people get to decide. Well, the Springfield City Council says, we don't want the people to decide this question. We're going to pass this ordinance and then repeal it in 30 days. So,
effectively saying that you, the voter, don't know what you want. We have to protect you. We have to not allow this to happen because you, the voter that went out and voted for this,
is afraid,
not competent.
They were afraid it would pass. As it stood, that whole pass and repeal maneuver was illegal. You know, the city council didn't allow that, so they faced a federal lawsuit and we won. They settled for $225,000.
In which you took the funds to.
Yeah, the city of Springfield is the single biggest donor to marijuana law reform in the state of Missouri.
Way to go. I want to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Jaws of Justice on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Jessica Thomas, and my guest is Eben Thampey. And Eben and I are discussing what's going on in regionally as well. We're talking about this in regional, and we don't have a real big action going in. Though this is the time to get involved, to pick up the motivation for us to have a big election year in the next cycle, to have these things for us. So we're keeping an eye on what's happening around the country, and a lot of exciting things are happening. I think we have three states with legalization.
Two states and the District of Columbia.
What is that place anyways?
Should be a state.
Right, it should be a state, but it's, okay. So we've got things coming up. So our attitudes are slowly shifting towards this. And the truth is out there. A lot of people have seen it's big pharma. A lot of reasons. The reasons are basically financially motivated, but the truth is out there. People are getting well from using cannabis, and it's being legal. And, I mean, there's issues even where the VA is giving and prescribing to soldiers in Colorado cannabis for post-traumatic stress, yet if you're not a soldier that came home from war, serving and protecting your country, and you come home to Missouri, you're a criminal. And you're not allowed to have the same things as your comrades in arms. So there's a lot of things we're going to be watching this time around this election cycle. More importantly, these people are going to get out and turn out the vote, or rock the vote. We're looking at Oregon, Alaska, D.C.,
and then Florida has medical marijuana on the ballot, and I believe Guam is looking at a decriminalization ballot as well.
And that could really change the tide of where we're going.
Yeah, I mean, we already have
but
two
legal
states.
How long was it before slavery was abolished, really?
That took a while.
I think Missouri was the last, kicking and screaming, brought into the... I'm not going to say that for sure.
Right.
I'm not a historian.
Well,
moving
past slavery definitely took a while, and Missouri was not one of the first states there. But Missouri does have a good chance in leading the way in the 2016 electoral cycle on
And I'm trying not to make that as light, joking slavery. I'm making that comparison to the new Jim Crow and the new plantation. And in prison systems. So I'm not trying to take slavery lightly. I'm saying comparing that to what's currently going on, which is the modern current form of slavery.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Taking so many families. I mean, I think the numbers are way over 50% or 70% in Kansas City of African-American households that do not have a male in the house that is incarcerated. This war definitely needs to motivate not just the African Americans in our community, but every individual. This affects us. Every family, I think you could talk to, we have some impact in their lives due to this war on drugs. You know, whether it's a grandmother raising grandkids because parents are absent, but when the head of the household that provides the food, puts the food on the table, is taken out of the equation, and the homes are lost, children and families are separated, families are destroyed. Interestingly enough, Show Me Cannabis has several billboards that are up and around the state and a new one coming into effect.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are told that today, actually, a billboard will be going up here in Kansas City. Let me pull up the address. It'll be at the intersection of Benton Boulevard and South I-70. So basically, I think that's Northeast Kansas City, but
Benton,
I'm not exactly 70. Sure.
Yeah, that's just right around the corner.
Yeah, oh yes, very good.
Yeah, right. We're close. It's very close. That's a really nice high traffic area. And the message on that billboard, do you know?
I believe the message on that billboard will be a medical marijuana message. There is a medical marijuana refugee from Missouri. Her name's Jacqueline Patterson. She has cerebral palsy, and if you go on YouTube, she's the subject of an extraordinary little video. Mm-hmm. She has cerebral palsy, and she cannot talk clearly without stuttering. She has a terrible stutter. But in this video, she picks up a marijuana joint and smokes it. And while she is smoking it, you see her spasms subside and she's able to talk completely normally. It's an extraordinary bit of video.
And we need to thank Jacqueline for putting her face to that billboard.
And she's had to leave Missouri to get her medicine, you know, as many other of her friends have.
There's a large contingency in Colorado and Washington that are there because they've had to leave the state to avoid persecution.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. You know, I think we've had on your show before Abby Rowe, who's a Ehlers-Danlos syndrome patient who is now a resident of Denver, Colorado. She's from St. Louis, wants to live in St. Louis, but, you know,
people
without marijuana,
come
she can't stay alive, so she has to be in Colorado. And then later this month, Brandy Johnson, who has a son, Trace. Trace has diprosopa, which is a genetic condition. He is he's the victim of intractable epilepsy. He has a lot of seizures all the time, essentially. You know, he needs marijuana, cannabis therapy. So they're moving to Colorado Springs later this month to get that. Again, you know, this could be happening here in Missouri, but they don't have the time to wait.
Right, and it's time to get out. We're getting real close to winding up our show, so we should spend the next few at the end of this just to let people know what is on the ballots across the United States and what we're looking to happen. What do you see?
So legalization this cycle is, I believe, a very strong possibility in three states. Right now, Washington, D.C. has a legalization ballot. I believe that will pass. Alaska has a legalization ballot funded and organized by the Marijuana Policy Project. I believe that will pass, but Alaska is a very difficult state to get accurate polling on.
Right, because they're
such
so spread out.
Big state. And,
right, but they've had something in place for years,
The Alaska Constitution protects basically growing at home, but it does not allow for, you know, they have a very strong right to privacy encoded in their Constitution that essentially lets you grow at home, but they don't have commercial production. Now, there is a Missourian, a chief of police, his name's Larry Kirk. He's a speaker for law enforcement against prohibition and also the sitting police chief of Old Monroe, Missouri, which is in St. Charles County. But he's been traveling around Alaska, stumping for legalization. So we certainly hope he's had a substantial effect on the public discourse there. So that's Alaska. Oregon is probably also the strongest candidate for passing. The polls are great there. They had a failed legalization initiative in 2012. This time around, however, the coalition is much more organized and much better funded.
So what
and actually, the people behind the legalization movement in Oregon are all from Columbia, Missouri. You wouldn't believe it. But, you know, I mentioned Anthony Johnson, who is one of the...
We run out of time.
Oh, well.
My goodness. you're absolutely right. And Mike, we would like to thank Mike Murphy for engineering for us and Eben Thampy of Americans for Forfeiture Control, for Forfeiture Reform, Eben. We burned up that time. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
Luckily, I ran into my friend, Mr. Eben Thampy, and let me get your thoughts. What do you think of this conference so far?
I love SSGP. You know, this is a great meeting of activists and intellectuals, and I look forward to seeing a lot of positive change develop, you know, as a result of this conference and the ones before it.
Yeah. Now, Eben, you travel the country a lot. You get a chance to take the pulse of America in regards to drug war and the various, I'm going to call them shenanigans that just keep going on. Your thought there, what do you see in these days?
You know, I'm particularly reminded of some focus groups we did in Missouri back a couple of years ago on marijuana legalization. And what we're finding in these, you know, relatively conservative areas in Missouri is that ordinary people have by and large seen the failure of drug prohibition. They understand it's a waste of money. They may not always understand the path forward, but they see the failure of the policy. And that's something I've seen time and time again as I go around the country, is that ordinary people have an understanding of how deeply the government has failed.
You know, I keep hearing this this chord that speaks to the fact that a lot of people, as you say, recognize the futility of this, but they don't know if their neighbors or their friends or their coworkers feel the same, and therefore it's like a taboo subject which keeps Well, it keeps progress at minimum.
Yeah. You know, the real opposition is still there. It's still law enforcement that's funded by asset forfeiture and federal grants. It's still opioid pharmaceutical manufacturers and the forest rehab treatment industry. But besides that, there's not much opposition, you know, and really it's just overcoming the inertia of the mainstream and generating enough support to get to that tipping point.
When you travel the country, I mean, you were in Ferguson, a month ago, approximate, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see the stories in the press. What was your perception? What did you see going on there?
Well, I'll tell you. So I was in Ferguson on August 9th, 2014, which is a night that that Darren Wilson from the Ferguson Police Department shot and killed Michael Brown. And I'd actually come into St. Louis to do some outreach and to see some music, and we were about to go out, and then we turn on the TV, and we see a SWAT team sniper standing guard over a prayer vigil in the apartment complex, you know, quarter mile away, and we said, we have to, you know, we're canceling our plans, we have to go see this.
We'll have part two of this discussion with Mr. Eapen Thappe on tomorrow's report. Please tune in. This is Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. Here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow?
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed or those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Jessica Thomas, host of Before the Dawn on Sunday morning from 4 to 7 a.m. Our outro music is Better Man from the Plan for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beauticious Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and Eco Radio, KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta musical.
Smile on my face. Lord, I'm gonna teach myself. How to understand. Gonna make myself a better man. Okay.